You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 12th to the 18th of February 2015. My name is John Elms and I am joined today by editor John Gill, news editor Simon Baker, deputy features editor Paul Jump and reporter Chris Havergal. Before we start, the higher education world has mourned the death this week of one of its best-known academics, Sir David Watson. Sir David, Professor of Higher Education at the University of Oxford, was a pioneer in the sector, and his passing has evoked numerous tributes from all corners of the academy. He was also a respected and regular commentator for Times Higher Education, and we join others in passing our condolences to his family and close friends. Research Excellence Framework has never been far away from the headlines since its results were published in December last year, and it continues to make waves. In our splash today, an academic has estimated that the real, in inverted commas, cost of the REF exceeds an eye-watering £1 billion. Paul will have a little more on that shortly. In other news, a report has stated that more than 12,000 international students may have lost places at UK colleges following a Home Office crackdown on immigration fraud. The report also suggests that few of these students have had their fees refunded. Chris Havergal has the lowdown on another highly charged situation there. Our cover feature this week focuses on money in HE. With the cap on student numbers about to be lifted, Professor Danny Dorling from the University of Oxford has picked over the trends in admissions to see what we might expect in the future. John Gill will be taking the lead on that one. But first, an academic has predicted the cost of the REF and it could exceed £1 billion, Paul. How did he arrive at this estimate?
On the back of a fag packet, as he readily admits. And I should say his name is Robert Bowman. He's a professor of physics, I think it is, at Queen's University Belfast. Basically, he looked at the official estimates of the cost of the last REE. Obviously, we don't have the estimates yet for the REF, but the last REE, Hefke commissioned an independent report that put the cost of that £47 million for the whole sector. And he reckons that that's just wildly out. Or being a physicist, he starts talking here about orders of magnitude. He thinks it's an order of magnitude out. And he doesn't claim to have, you know, all the accurate figures about how much time everybody's put into it and all the rest of it. But he's nevertheless, with a little help from Excel, done a few calculations that estimate the cost. He gets £1.2 billion. He reckons that you could tweak it down to about £500 million potentially, but he doesn't reckon that you could realistically get it much lower than that.
48 million wouldn't even pay for all the press releases that were sent out on the 18th of December, would they?
Arguably not, no.
Presumably this is his point, because, I mean, for just under shy of 50 million for the cost of the REF, he says that's wildly too low. Mm. And what are the kind of things that he said, that, you know, the costing to get him up to £1 billion? Because there's quite a big disparity between £1 billion and 50 million.
Yeah, well, he thinks the official estimates don't take any realistic account of how much time academics actually spend on preparing their submissions, going to meetings about submissions, in the case of the REF, writing impact case studies, never mind all the central administration. I should say his figure actually excludes any cost for academics sitting on the REF panels themselves, not to mention Hefke's own costs. So, you know, the total cost could be higher than that.
Can I ask something, Paul? You've spent such a lot of time thinking about all this. What's your view? Say we accept a figure of £500 million, just for argument's sake, and a lot of that is opportunity cost. It's money. It's effectively the salaries paid to academics who could have been spending that time doing something else,
yeah,
such as research, perhaps.
Yeah,
even excellent research. But clearly it's not cash, it's not actual pounds that have been paid out to some sort of REF cashier or anything like that. Do you think that's a fair calculation? I mean, is that real money that's gone out of the system? It's a bit like saying, you know, when the police say that they spent £1 million policing a football match. Well, yeah, to a certain extent, but equally all they were doing was employing those police officers who otherwise would have been doing whatever police officers do. I'm not really sure about this, but
yeah.
fighting crime, I suppose.
Well, it's an interesting philosophical question, isn't it? You could argue it's just part of the job description,
yeah,
and therefore effectively doesn't cost anything. But I mean, I suppose the other thing that's worth saying is that however expensive the REF is, distributing research funding in another way, namely through the research councils, is even more expensive. considerably more expensive. Some estimates put it at 10 times more expensive in terms of the amount of money actually costs to review all the grants and all the rest of it. So it's still, you could argue, relatively cheap.
Yeah, and Professor Bowman doesn't mention that he thinks that the $1 billion is excessive. He says the REF is an essential audit, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, he himself doesn't really express a view on whether that's too much. He just, I mean, his point is essentially that before you can ask a question like that, you need a realistic estimate of what it actually costs.
Mm.
And essentially he's calling on other academics to look at his spreadsheet and suggest improvements, suggest more realistic figures, and that, you know, collaboratively this, he thinks the sector should be coming up with a proper figure rather than leaving it to people like consultants that have key commissions to come up with the official figure.
Yeah.
I think the point, I suppose the point is, if even if it's the actual figure is more like sort of hundreds of millions, then as pointed out by David Price in the piece, then you're still talking about a kind of small percentage of the actual money that ends up being distributed, and that money is distributed for several years as well.
Mm.
So when you compare that with, as Paul says, the research councils, which it talks about that, you know, being about 10% the cost of how much money is actually distributed, then it makes it quite almost laughable that there's all this speculation that if they were going to get rid of one stream of research funding, it would be the QR funding, which is obviously done on the basis of the REF. So it seems like it's a lot more efficient, even if the actual cost is a lot higher than it's been officially estimated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, lots of stuff to chew over. You can find that story on pages 6 and 7 in the magazine, and no doubt there'll be essential reading for a fair few in the sector. Chris, you have another visa story for us, one of the thorniest issues around, visa issues in the higher education world. What's been happening now?
This all stems back to June last year when the right of the three universities and a number of private colleges to recruit international students was suspended amid the allegations that their English language qualifications weren't up to scratch. Since then, there's been a lot of focus on the fate of the institutions involved, but there's been less focus on the fate of the students, particularly those students at the 65 private colleges, which have since had their licence, which allows them to sponsor students, revoked. That's what a new report out from the National Union of Students tries to do, and it does two main things. Firstly, it gives an estimate of the number of students who are affected by this. According to the Home Office figures, there were about 5,000 students who had been told they had 60 days to find a new place to study or leave the UK. But the NUS say that that figure actually excludes a large number of the students involved, and they estimate that the real total was more than 12,000 students who have had to either find a new place to study or to leave the UK. The second thing which the report does is actually look at, well, if there's those 12,000 students, what's actually happened to them? It's quite difficult to get an answer to that, in that many of these students will have just left the country pretty swiftly. But they have been able to do a survey of 288 students who are affected, and it finds that of those students, actually none of the students they surveyed had had any success in getting a refund on their fees, quite possibly because if many of these colleges have lost their licence to recruit, they'll have simply just shut down. And perhaps as a result of that, very few of them have had much success in finding a place to study elsewhere in the UK.
Right. Certainly a delicate matter. Did the NUS, I mean, in this report, did the NUS offer any opinion on what should be being done about this in terms of refunding students?
I mean, certainly the NUS and indeed other sector organisations which have been part of a working group looking at this have said that these students should be given the same sort of assistance that happened when London Met had problems with its licence to recruit internationally a couple of years ago. Some of that is around a bit of leeway on visas, but also, you know, some of that is around finances. What is striking about this episode is that the same sort of support that was forthcoming then hasn't been forthcoming on this occasion.
Well, yeah, certainly a delicate matter, one I'm sure that we'll hear of more in, and that's on page 8 if you're looking for it in the magazine. John, our cover feature looks at student admissions in anticipation of the student number cap coming off. What was Danny Dorling discovered for us in this feature?
Yeah, so Danny Dolling's well known as a sort of one of the foremost commentators on inequality, which is obviously a very hot topic sort of across the political sphere at the moment. And he's done a really detailed and a sort of blow-by-blow analysis of this changing landscape of university admissions, which has undergone all sorts of shifts, and you know, the pressures on universities are changing very dramatically because of the marginalisation of higher education. And it's really interesting. I mean, he tracks a whole bunch of different trends here, some of which are very counterintuitive, some of which are exactly as you'd expect. But just to give a few examples, he talks about the rise of the BTEC as a qualification that's actually opening up access to higher education to an awful lot of students from quite disadvantaged backgrounds. With some really interesting figures in that. I think we reported just last week that 4 in 10 students admitted to Manchester Met last year came in with BTECs. I mean, that is a really significant shift in the way universities are actually, the groups of students they're accessing. So he looks at some of those issues. He looks at the way that the very impoverished job market at the moment is encouraging, you know, record numbers of students into higher education, over the 500,000 mark of students accepting places for the first time. But he also points out that, you know, while there's lots of really positive figures, headline figures looking really good both for universities and for widening access, if you actually look in detail behind some of that, it's not always the runaway success story you might expect it to be. So, for example, he flags that there's a 40% headline rise in widening participation, which looks very good. But to put that in perspective, it is, in fact, he says, an increase from just 2.3% to 3.2% of the children from the poorest areas of the UK getting into the most elite universities between 2011 and 2014. And he points out that for every 100 children, that's not even a whole extra child from those very poorest universities getting into very poorest backgrounds getting up into our top universities. So although some of the headline figures are, you know, look really impressive, actually the devil is in the detail, and it's not always the story, perhaps, at that level that you'd expect just from looking at the top line figures. So huge amounts of detail in there. I won't go through it all now, but really very well worth a close look for anyone interested in how the, you know, the market has changed things as far as university admissions is concerned.
Absolutely. Professor Dorling has gone over the student admissions with a fine tooth comb, and it's jam-packed with data and well worth a read. That's on page 36 in the magazine. As I mentioned at the start of the podcast, one of the heavyweights of higher education, Sir David Watson, passed away on the 9th of February, and his death has saddened the sector. Simon, you tweeted at the time you'd spoken to him about a few stories, and just how significant a figure was he in the higher education? We have a story about him in the magazine this week. How significant a figure was he?
Now, I think this clearly came as quite a shock to a lot of people, because he was still writing quite a lot and pretty prolific in the last sort of couple of years, and had produced some quite important papers on higher education and quite important speeches. You know, just last year we featured some work that he did looking at some of the risks faced by the sector, where he was kind of commenting on, you know, the risk that the Russell Group posed to the sort of sector's unity. And I think that's why it was such a surprise to so many people, because, you know, he was foremost in people's minds sort of in recent times when it came to higher education research. But in terms of his sort of significant sort of contribution, you know, first off, he led Brighton basically to become a university, you know, through the 92 reforms. To a lot of people of that era, he turned Brighton into a very successful post-92 university. He then went on to lead Brighton right up into the middle of the first decade of the century. And, you know, a lot of his contemporaries kind of had a lot of praise for him. You know, others that sort of were around at the time that a lot of the old polytechnics became universities, like Roger Brown, have spoken of his contribution. He was on the Deering Review into higher education in the late 90s. He passionately argued a lot about the need for a proper credit transfer system in higher education, and how that was really lacking in this country, because obviously at the moment a big problem is that students go to university but they're stuck at that university pretty much. They can't say very easily at the end of the year one, you know, I'm going to stop now, I'm going to take my credit and go somewhere else. That's an aspect of the US system with the community colleges that works very well. And he argued quite passionately that would really open up higher education to a lot of people, a lot more people. So, you know, you could envisage a system where people started in one place, went on to like more selective institutions later on. So you know, in a lot of ways he was, you know, a real champion of, you know, WP and also kind of the more modern universities and not just universities that are all resting on their laurels as you know, and their reputations. So I think that's what won him a lot of kind of plaudits.
I think in a sector where we don't have very large numbers of professors of higher education who are real experts in the field of, you know, this is the business we're in and looking at very closely at it. He was one of the foremost professors in that area and a thoroughly nice man as well, hugely supportive of colleagues. I mean, that comes through in all the tributes we've had to him. And yeah, I completely agree with Simon. You know, I strongly remember a talk he gave where he talked about that credit transfer point and he made the point that it's extraordinary that every single level of education you step up through in this country, you will improve your earning potential, to put, you know, a crude measure on it, except if you go to university and drop out. So if you go to university, do a year and decide that you've chosen the wrong course perhaps, and because you can't transfer, you drop out instead, you'll actually have a lower likely income than if you had never gone to that university in the first place. That's not true in America, where they have credit transfer and you're given credit for doing a year of higher education. And it does seem like a bit of a mad system that we don't have something that allows you to sort of benefit from that. But I mean, that's just one of the many, many points that he kind of picked up and was a, you know, a bit of a dog with a bone as far as some of those issues were concerned. He wouldn't they wouldn't stop arguing for them if he thought they were the right thing for the sector to do.
Absolutely. Certainly, he will be sadly missed, and our story in the magazine includes several tributes from some of his former colleagues and people in the sector. I'm afraid that's all we have time for this week's issue review. But as always, you will find comprehensive coverage of the magazine, coverage in the magazine, I should say. Also, don't forget, if you'd like to comment on any of the content in this week's edition, you can find us all on all manners of social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and of course on our very own website, www.timeshighereducation.co.uk. Until next week then, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.